Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. I want to kick this month off by shouting out the Supercast. It's how I fund the show and turn this into the best and biggest podcast I can. Would really appreciate the support. You can go to realignment.supercast.com. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. I definitely know that during these hard economic times that everyone could do this. So I want to say a huge shout out to everyone who supported the show so far. On to today's episode. I'm speaking with Lyle Jeremy Rubin. This episode was originally going to appear on Veterans Day, but I really enjoyed Lyle's new book, Pain is Weakness, Leaving the Body, A Marine's Unbecoming. So I decided I was going to release the episode today, the date of the book's actual publication. I've done a lot of coverage of the war in Ukraine and debates about the future of U.S. foreign policy. Lyle, then, is an interesting guest because, like many people who listen to The Realignment and like myself, he's seen himself go all over the ideological spectrum over the past 20 years. He's gone from being a Dennis Prager and Jonah Goldberg interning college Republican to actually getting his PhD and becoming a leftist critic of American hegemony abroad. So I thought it'd be a great time as the left debates its future, given the context of the fact that we've moved on from the war on terror and moved on to the era of great power competition. This would really be a great time to have this conversation. A huge shout out to Lincoln Network for supporting the podcast. And of course, if you enjoy this conversation, you could find Pain is Weakness Leaving the Body, A Marine's Unbecoming at the bookshop or anywhere you purchase your books from. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Lyle Jeremy Rubin, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you. This was originally going to be an episode that's going to come on Veterans Day, but honestly, I love the book so much that we're just going to release it with publication date in mind. Let's kind of start here. The title is Pain is Weakness Leaving the Body, A Marine's Unbecoming. You were a Marine officer serving in Afghanistan, obviously. Here's the question that's raised by the subtitle. What would you say you've become then?
I mean, the story is basically about my kind of conversion experience from a tool of empire or a weapon for empire to a self-conscious critic of empire. So I think the easiest way of answering that is I became someone who's now forever critical and aware, extremely aware, sometimes torturously aware of how the empire is all around us and how it affects us, not just in foreign policy regards, but also at much more personal levels.
You know, that's interesting. Could you contextualize this for me and the audience? What does the term empire mean to you in November 2022? One of the things we're going to get into in this conversation, obviously, is there's this real post-9/11 period that you respond to, that I grew up in. The moment after the withdrawal from Afghanistan looks a little different in a couple of different ways. So for right now, like, what does being critical of empire mean to you?
So there's all sorts of different definitions of empire. I think in the sense that most Americans understand it, it's territorial empire. Usually we're talking about annexed land or occupied land or colonial empire. There's also economic empire. If you read the academic literature on this, a lot of like economic empire ends up becoming what academics call neocolonialism. So, you know, there comes a point in history where you no longer need to literally occupy or colonize different lands. You can just use economic institutions to control the people there and to exploit the people there. That's kind of a very, very brief, simple crash course in different definitions of empire. But I would argue that it's also a kind of political culture and a general ethos that every society that is an empire, particularly ones as conspicuous as ours, we end up being centered around our imperial identity. So in the broadest sense, empire is about one group of people dominating another group of people. So domination is central to empire and central to imperialism. And what I argue in the book is that this domination doesn't only take place in Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen or all across Africa, as it is right now, or as it has in the past 20 years or so. It also takes place within U.S. borders. It obviously takes place in over-policed neighborhoods and communities, where a lot of the police themselves are using the gear and the equipment that people like myself used in places like Afghanistan. But it also takes place in our workplaces. You know, we've had increasingly surveilled and disciplined, and in some ways even over-policed workplaces in recent years and recent decades. And I don't think that can be entirely separated from the rise of militarization and militarism, which all follows from a renewed imperialism in the United States, particularly since 9/11.
You know, that's interesting. I want to ask another question then about your background. You've been described in a couple recent appearances as a anti-war activist. And as we're talking about this, let's say, post-2021 period, not to say that engagement in Afghanistan is over, not to say there isn't still engagement in the Middle East, but I'm really just treating these as concerted eras as a useful framework. If we're talking about being anti-war in 2009, I could assume you would be against the surge in Afghanistan and against the surge in Iraq. You'd be against the war on terror. You'd be opposed to President Obama's drone campaigns and George W. Bush's unilateral foreign policy. In the year 2022, what does it mean to be anti-war? Because there's a tension between the anti-imperialist project and I would say the anti-war project. And that kind of explains a bit of the controversy you're having on the left between, let's say, AOC and people to her left when it comes to the Ukraine policy. So define anti-war today.
Yeah, sure. Actually, like I personally, my first preference is not to define myself as anti-war per se, or even at this point, even an activist. I mean, I do counter recruitment work in schools, but a lot of the activism I've done in the past, I just don't have the time anymore, unfortunately, to do it. But I think of myself as an anti-imperialist, and I would love to live in a world without war and without militaries. But that's not the world that we'll be living in the foreseeable future. And I also have sympathy for, certain groups of people. If they are being oppressed, I think sometimes they deserve the right, and I will support them to bear arms to protect themselves and defend their own autonomy. For me, anti-imperialism is about power relations, wealth relations and power relations between nations, between peoples. And really, at the end of the day, when we're talking about the imperialism that we deal with today, global ruling classes and everyone else. So I'm much more concerned about transforming, challenging the global wealth and power relations that is led still, despite some challenges in recent years, is still very much led by the United States and Europe and its allies in the global North. And it's largely those in the global South that are bearing the brunt of this power relation. So that's what I'm most interested in. So when it comes to Ukraine, I mean, this opens a whole can of worms. I personally don't feel entirely confident speaking about the nitty-gritty of Ukraine. I'm not a scholar on Ukraine or Russia. What I will say is that one thing that has bothered me about the whole debate on the left and even across the spectrum is a lot of people across the spectrum have absorbed this kind of Cold War assumption that Russia is the East and Europe and the United States are the West. And, you know, nowhere shall the two meet or something along those lines. But the fact is, Russia has always been part of the story of European colonialism and European empire. And I think the Cold War, to a large degree, was a competition between competing, we can argue to the extent to which Russia is part of Europe. Technically, part of Russia is part of Europe, part of the continent of Europe. Culturally, when we learn the Western canon, we read Dostoevsky, we read Tolstoy. I mean, it's very much considered part of the Western European tradition when it comes to the literary and cultural world. But you know, putting that aside, I think it is very clear that Russia has always been part of the types of forms of global or regional domination that I write about. And I think the Cold War was also part of that story. And I think the War on Terror was part of this story. People forget that the US was partnered with Putin's Russia in the earlier years of the War on Terror, and that Putin's intervention in Chechnya was part of that War on Terror. And in some ways was a prehistory of the War on Terror. So I like starting from that point, because then it basically prevents me and others from having to pick sides. I mean, if you are opposed to empire, if you are opposed to any kind of domination, you should be very critical of both the United States and Putin's Russia. With that said, you know, the United States is a much more powerful and wealthy government and force in the world than Russia is. So that complicates things. Personally, I stand with the Ukrainians. I would be the last person to say that because the U.S. is still the global hegemon, Ukrainians therefore should be left to the devices of one of U.S.'s adversaries, which in this case is Russia. I think that logic, in my mind, is an empty, really self-defeating logic. So I personally support arming Ukraine. I think if the world were to allow Russia to occupy and dominate the Ukrainians in much the way that the world allowed the United States to occupy and dominate Iraq and Afghanistan and a good part of the greater Middle East in the last 20 years, if Russia is allowed to do that, and if the U.S. is allowed to do that, then we're going to continue to live in an imperialized world. So, you know, when it comes to the specifics, how long should we arm the Ukrainians? Yeah. How should that be done in conjunction with diplomacy? I defer to others, friends of mine, actually, people like Stephen Wertheim and people at, Quincy Institute, and I could name a number of other people in a number of different organizations, but that's more or less where I stand on the question of Ukraine.
No, and this is why I wanted to speak with you, because I think you, in your body of work and your interest, I think you get at some of the vulnerabilities and the contradictions. So for example, you're talking about the global South, and you're talking about the U.S. kind of placing itself in the position of competition with Russia. And you also no doubt know that when Vladimir Putin gives speeches about his actions in Ukraine, he speaks about the global South. He talks about Western imperialism, kind of appropriates that language. And it seems as if part of the difficulty that folks on the left have thinking this through, once again, we're putting aside like the tactical, like specific, how big is the aid package? How long does it go? There's been some difficulty navigating those contradictions. So could you speak to the idea that you are someone who's opposed to this broad, let's say, US-centric imperialism and then economic hegemony, but then Putin is using that argument to act in bad faith in Ukraine? How should someone who shares your ideological prerogatives sort through the good and the bad faith here?
Yeah, sure. I think actually the way you framed it is more or less correct. I think Putin and others, other adversaries of the United States that in my mind are not really anti-imperialist or anti-capitalist or left-wing forces at all in the world, are do appropriate the language of leftists, the language of anti-capitalists, the language of anti-imperialists, imperialism for their own purposes. And I think that's a really good place to start, is acknowledging that this is an opportunistic appropriation. Putin has a long history of not only enabling all forms of vicious capitalism, both within and without Russia's borders, but also all sorts of forms of imperialism and colonialism, and not just in Ukraine. We could talk about Georgia. We could talk about Syria. So I think that's, again, a good place to start. I think, you know, ultimately, we have to acknowledge that the situation we're now in is to a large degree an impossible situation. In other words, it's a situation in which there are no clean or preferable choices. Whatever choice we make, whether it's arming Ukraine or not arming Ukraine, or extending this war indefinitely or not extending this war indefinitely, there are awful risks and awful costs on all sides. And the reason for that is because there has been no real mass global effort to move beyond empire and imperialism as an overarching project, both among elites and among people in general. And at one point, I would argue there was. I would say the middle third of the 20th century, both people in the global south in the form of the non-aligned movement, and then also in the form of the new international economic order, which Adam Getachew, in her wonderful book, World Making After Empire, writes about. And also Christy Thornton in her work writes about similar politics in Mexico and across Latin America. There was a real push to try to move. It wasn't just going to be this kind of formal decolonization where the elites in Africa or the elites in Latin America take over capitalist responsibilities that were being superintended by European powers before that. It was a much more robust vision where the actual people of Africa, the people of Latin America, the people of Asia, and also, by the way, the people of the global north, who are also in a lot of ways being dominated and exploited, actually enjoy real autonomy and something like real democratization of wealth and power in their own societies. But that vision, for a variety of reasons, dissipated in recent decades. And this is the type of situation we end up without a robust mass global anti-imperialism. You end up with ever dangerous, ever escalating imperialist rivalries. So if there was one thing I would insist upon, it's yes, let's have the debates on arming Ukraine or diplomacy, all of that. These are absolutely debates we need to have, especially in the context of nuclear escalation risks. But I think there's a real misplacement of priorities where there's hardly no discussion at all about transforming our global institutions, transforming the IMF, transforming the World Bank, transforming the World Economic Forum or the Federal Reserve, which actually plays a major role in the power of the dollar, you know, throughout the world, you know, democratizing all these institutions. So not only people in the global south, but poor and working people across the entire world have more of a say and more economic power to have that say.
You know, you have a PhD, you obviously now you have a PhD, but I think when it's coming to that things you're talking about, the key thing here is you're talking about the vision issue. And it seems that the vision is what leads to reform, radicalism, pick your poison in terms of the process you choose. But give me an articulation of what a post-empire world could look like. Because just to give a bit of meat to the complication here, I think it's easy to say in the year 2021, the U.S. is incredibly engaged in Western Europe, Central Europe, parts of Eastern Europe. Obviously, we haven't acquired territory, but obviously there's a complicated relationship when it comes to NATO. A post-imperial world could be one maybe where the United States has not deployed troops, bases, resources across the world. However, if you are a Pole sitting in November 2022, you are no doubt glad that there are U.S. forces sitting in your country at this specific moment. That's the tension there. So what does a post-empire world look like? And B, how does post-empire not just result in autarky, or not even autarky, but just chaos? And Japan rebuilding its military and getting nuclear weapons, same for South Korea, same for Poland. Those two questions, I think, are really key.
No, and I don't pretend to there's an easy solution to all this, or that there aren't, again, risks in all directions. And, you know, I guess what I would say is that there are people that are doing this important work right now that are trying to figure out what this post-imperial would look like, you know, at a very micro granular level. Sam Moyne in his book, Not Enough, Jamie Martin in his book, The Meddlers. I mean, there's a, so there's a lot of scholars out there that are trying to do this important work. And the problem isn't that they're not getting anywhere with this work. It's the problem is no, there's not enough people paying attention to the work. I mean, most Americans and most people around the world, quite frankly, have no idea that we can live, that maybe we can live in a world that doesn't just involve great powers risking nuclear holocaust at every given moment. I mean, this isn't even a lot, you know, most people unfortunately can't really even imagine that world. So I think the first steps is at least positing that world and putting it forth to people to debate. You know, I think there's this common thing that happens in politics where everyone assumes from the get-go, this is the world. You know, it's like there is no alternative. The famous Tina, referring to the neoliberal Thatcherite Reaganite world that we've lived in for half a century. And then the flip side of that is a kind of normalization of what in fact is like a systemic like horror. like the world we live in is horrific. You know, if you actually, you know, really pay attention to what's happened the past 20 years in the greater Middle East, in the wars that America led and the other wars that followed from America's wars, particularly in Syria and Yemen, you know, the amount of violence is truly horrific. And the horror that we're constantly playing with, the horror that we're playing with right now in Ukraine, you know, the possibility of some kind of nuclear war, that, you know, I mean, we can't even really fathom what happens if a nuke actually goes off at this point. And by the way, the nukes that we now have in the world are like 80 times more powerful than the nukes that the United States deployed at the end of World War II in Japan. So in any case, I think like if you really acknowledge the horror that we're already living in and you really understand that and are very that you're aware of it, then you have no choice but to spend all your time trying to figure out how to transcend or overcome these horrors or prevent the escalation of them. And I feel like that's what my writing to a large degree is about, is just getting people, specifically Americans, but also people around the world, to actually acknowledge the world that we actually live in, as opposed to the fairy tales that we tell ourselves. And then once you have that sense of horror, then it's like, you know, asking someone, well, what if we can't move beyond? What if this is our only option? It's like asking someone who's about to, you know, be murdered. What if there's no choice but for you to get murdered? I mean, of course, that's an impossible question for that person if they actually realize they're about to be murdered. You know, to a large degree, I think the dilemmas and crises that we're now facing when it comes to the nuclear arms race and nuclear escalation, the climate crisis, the overall social crisis in the world right now with the rise of, you know, all sorts of authoritarian governments. I don't think that metaphor is that far off. Like in my mind, we have no choice but to imagine worlds beyond the systems of domination that we now live in. And I think the problem is not that we can't move beyond, it's that we don't have enough people and resources being devoted to these questions. So, you know, I know I think you're pushing me to be a little more precise, but
no,
I think.
No. So I want to say one thing real quick.
Yeah. Sure.
You mentioned this on a different podcast you appeared on. You said, quote, I think if you ask me a question, I'll just list off a bunch of books, authors, things people should look at. Look, right. This is the book show. So please do that. And I think you've done a good job of contextualizing where you are here, because once again, people should be wary if you gave me a 15-second perfect soundbite on what, like, I hope, by the way, if you had that soundbite and it was accurate, you'd be doing more than appearing on podcasts right now. So please embrace that. It's good.
So one in that spirit, one more book recommendation that hardly no one knows about, as far as I can tell. It's a book called A Possible World. It was written in the early 2000s by two Finnish scholars. I'm forgetting their name right now, but they're scholars from Finland. And it really gives like a very nuts and bolts model for how to reform the United Nations, how to reform the General Assembly and the Security Council, how to reform the World Bank and the IMF, the Federal Reserve, the relation of the dollar, which is the world's reserve currency at the moment. You know, so it really gives, and I'm not saying that all of the proposals that they put forward, I mean, this is a book that's been around for 20 years now, so some of it is clearly outdated. But I think, you know, it does certainly point in the right direction. And there have been other books since then that have come out. But I guess like what I'm calling for is a lot more of that work. And I'm not saying like there are so many people that are working on this work, but more attention from your average person and your average journalist and your average, you know, pundit on these types of questions, because these are the questions, the answers to these questions are ultimately are going to be the answers that determine our collective future. It's not going to be these more immediate debates that we're having.
And this may be too big of a question, so I don't expect a precise answer, but I'd love to hear your abstract theory of political change here. So you gave, I think, a good critique from your POV. Like, I disagree with you on some big things, but you're reflecting your POV well. You're looking at these global institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, domestic ones like the, you know, Federal Reserve. You're talking about how there's this lack of broad global movement embracing some type of alternative. But the key feature of all of these institutions that you've listed out, and I just relisted, is they are by definition the province of the elites. I think in many cases, like, that's a good thing. You know, it's easy to imagine a populist Federal Reserve that causes actual disaster. So when you're looking at the critique of these institutions, is your critique that, well, what we're going to do is we're going to have cadres of leftists who can wield power the right way, or we need more aggressive movements that could topple the world order and build something new? These are big 20th century debates that are obviously not going to solve here. But how do you just think about them at just like a baseline level when you're looking at those structures?
Sure. I mean, you're asking all the right and important questions, and naturally the most difficult questions to answer. I mean, but these are questions I struggle with all the time. So this is going to sound like a cop out, but I'm very much like a pluralist. I say this somewhat facetiously, but I'm with Mao here, you know, let a thousand blossoms bloom. And you know, I think that there's a space, a need for more social movement activism. And for me, I mean, I've arrived at a more kind of socialist understanding of how the world works. So for me, like the labor movement and labor struggles, and by that, I don't just mean trade unionism, although that's a central part of it, but even like non-unionized workers who aren't even seeking unions per se. There's been a lot of work when it comes to domestic labor and sex workers that where it's not traditional trade unions are not necessarily the answer there, but they're very much part of a broader labor struggle. And to me, first and foremost, like we need, you know, the labor movement just needs to keep on getting bigger and bigger and more robust, both within the United States and around the world. And the reason I say that is everything else, I mean, the one thing that people have is the right to forego their labor or the ability to forego their labor. That is the most powerful weapon that people have. I would argue. So I don't think it's a mistake. I don't think it's a coincidence that as the United States and other rich countries around the world and the world as a whole has become deunionized, things have gotten a lot more unequal and in a lot of ways, a lot more authoritarian, not just in the workplace, but in society as a whole, particularly in recent years. So to me, the labor struggle really needs to be front and center in any kind of strategy, overarching strategy. I feel uncomfortable speaking beyond that because it's just not what I I don't spend most of my time labor organizing. I've done some labor organizing. You know, I'm still involved to some degree with some organizing of that kind, but you know, it is not central to my everyday life. And I think there's people that can speak more compellingly on that front. But beyond the labor struggle, you know, like I said, I believe in, I think you need social movements, but I also do think you need policymakers and wonkish journalists and, you know, power brokers within the system. I think this is another binary that I find really troubling, this binary between like, do we pick electoralism or do we pick anti-electoralism?
Could you explain that debate real quick?
Yeah, sure. I mean, on the left, you're constantly, there's constantly just like these two groups of people that are at each other's throats. Like, do you try to reform the system from within by voting for certain politicians like AOC or Bernie Sanders, and by proposing certain reformist policies like Medicare for All or social housing? Or do you just, you know, try to mobilize enough people to effectively burn shit down? Uh-huh. And from that kind of mass mobilization, we could then kind of build something anew, I guess. You know, there's all sorts of different understandings of where that leads. But to me, I mean, it's always been clear to me that you need both, like, the people that are threatening to burn shit down, and you also need the people on the inside that are being responsive to those threats and pushing their colleagues to also be responsive to those threats. I mean, as a historian, it seems to me pretty clear that social democracy in Europe followed from this threat of revolution. To the extent that we were able to socialize the healthcare system and socialize the education system and socialize, well, not in the United States, but in most other parts of the world, childcare services, and basically create a somewhat generous floor for people, so they don't have to be terrified of ending up on the streets. Housing, of course, socializing housing. To the extent that that's happened, it happened because elites were afraid of more revolutionary possibilities from their left. And some of their colleagues, you know, persuaded them, hey, the alternative to revolution is maybe let's have something like universal healthcare. Let's have something like, enforced, mandated, you know, affordable housing, or even something like free housing for a certain portion of the population. So I don't know if that entirely answers your question, but to me, it's always a combination of more revolutionary energy and activity from the outside, and then more quote unquote pragmatic or technical labors from the inside among those that sympathize with those on the outside.
You know, I'm really curious about this is kind of the whole book, so don't want to spoil too much, but I'm just curious about your intellectual journey, because it's fascinating to me that your critique of U.S. foreign policy and, let's say, like the post-World War II liberal international order status quo is really tied into a like sophisticated critique of like American and European domestic politics. It seems like you usually see folks, you know, much more towards the center. When I talk to people on the left, like you, it's one or the other. Very few people are dabbling, and I don't want to say dabbling because you're a serious historian here, obviously, but you're focused on foreign policy and domestic policy. Which came first? Are you sitting in Afghanistan and you're asking broader questions about the U.S. engagement in the region, and then you start reading about that and you start noticing that capitalism comes up a lot, or is it like tied together? How do you think about that development?
Yeah. So, I mean, with me, I always was something of a generalist. I mean, in my academic work, I'm very much a specialist. I write about readings, anti-capitalist readings of Adam Smith in the United States, which is very much a specialized scholarship, to say the least. But I've always, you know, when I've throughout my life as a reader, I've always enjoyed reading people that kind of write about everything all at once. I just find that kind of way of thinking to be very enticing and helpful, along with the more specialized readings when it comes to really understanding the problems that we face. So, you know, before I joined the Marine Corps, I was reading the neoconservatives to a large degree. So, and I was reading, everything they wrote about. So a lot of the neoconservatives, we think of them now as these kind of foreign policy hawks, but the neoconservatives originally, as you know,
Gen One.
yeah, of course, we're writing about social and economic policy and we're critical of what they saw as the excesses of the left. But we're also critical of the absence of any really serious alternative from the right. And we're trying to put forth a social economic vision that addressed the concerns of the left without falling to their excesses, if that's a fair summary, with the journals like Public Interest and Commentary and all the rest. So I was reading a lot of that. I was reading a lot of the libertarians. I read a lot of Friedrich Hayek. I read a lot of Milton Friedman, the Chicago School. And then I also read those that were more focused on, what we now consider foreign policy. And a lot of them were the same people, like Norman Podhoretz, I could go on. The Crystals, all of them, they wrote seamlessly about both foreign policy and domestic policy. A lot of times it's as if it was all a single topic. For them, they ended up converging on this kind of capitalist ethic or vision, where it was about kind of just pushing for capitalism domestically and globally. And I guess you could say my politics is very much, my current politics is very, very much follows from that earlier politics. That at first I thought this was great, that pushing for capitalism in the United States while also pushing for it around the world. I mean, one way of looking at neoconservatism and to some degree even neoliberalism is that, it takes Wilson's famous adage, in order to make democracy safe at home, we have to make it safe around the world. But basically replacing the word democracy with capitalism. That was very much the intellectual climate that I was born and raised in. And it was the one that I first attached to. And it was ultimately the one that I ended up questioning and abandoning. Again, I don't know if that fully answers your question. But to me, it doesn't make any sense to separate domestic and foreign policy. To me, they're, a lot of the institutions, I mean, the Federal Reserve is one of many institutions that I can speak to in this regard. But a lot of these institutions that we think of as just domestic institutions are very much global institutions. I mean, Domestic Policing, another great book by Stuart Trader, Badges Without Borders, which is all about the linkages, the material personnel linkages between domestic policing and global counterinsurgency throughout the Cold War. These police precincts were not doing their thing in a vacuum, just like counterinsurgent fighters or spies were doing their thing in a vacuum I could name a million different places in Chile or, all across Africa. They were, a lot of times it was these same people that were policing the poor and unemployed in the United States and also policing anti-colonial resistance fighters, across the world.
Here's what I'm wondering. I'm sure a bunch of folks are wondering. This is in the self-development category of question. What really impresses me about your work and your thought is that obviously you've gone from being a Dennis Prager interning, Jonah Goldberg research assistant, Marine Corps officer to a leftist academic. So obviously there's a swing there in terms of like the specific policies and movements you're part of, but you don't seem like a reactionary. It doesn't seem like you're just kind of doing these semi-manic swings. And if there's a critique I can make of plenty of people who disagree with me, and you're kind of saying this in this like anti-imperialist discourse, this is a little like inside baseball, but like this is like kind of like the Tulsi Gabbards of the world. It's like one day you're this, the other day you're that, and you're vehement and it's super aggressive. How do you advise people change their mind about things as they should? Like you said, you looked at this project and you looked at it from a couple of different angles. How do you advise doing that while also not just purely becoming a reactionary?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I think there's different ways to answer this question, but when it comes to my own personal experience, it was all about like who I read. You know, there's this saying, like, you are what you eat, you know, you are what you read. And for a lot of reasons, I was always attracted to, you know, thinkers that were both very provocative and very interesting, but were also open-minded, and had a kind of open-minded spirit to them. And most of all, were very interested in always engaging with the best version of their interlocutor. So the best version of the opposing argument. And, you know, I have one writer friend who was really a mentor of mine when I was first starting to have doubts in the Marine Corps. There was this wonderful book that came out called What Are Intellectuals For? And it was by George Shalaba, who I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
No.
But he's a you know, hardworking book reviewer. He's written hundreds of book reviews. He used to be the book reviewer for the Boston Globe many years ago, and has written for just a variety of publications across the political spectrum. And he came out with this book called What Are Intellectuals Good For, which was a collection of a number of his review essays. And, you know, he's the one who really first kind of crystallized this for me. I mean, his whole form of reviewing is he reviews widely. I mean, he reviews people with all sorts of different politics and also all sorts of different life stories and experiences. And he, you know, and he always insisted in his writing. And then when I got to know him, that the trick is to just always engage with the best version of the opposing argument. And I think that's what will really save you from what you consider, you know, reactionary politics, what I consider it always, you know, if you don't do that, you end up with some version of a resentment fueled politics where you're no longer really invested in what originally got you into politics, which for most of us, I still believe like what originally gets most of us in politics is legitimate concerns about legitimate problems. And you end up just kind of every day waking up and looking for more resentment fuel targeted at this or that real or imagined group of people. And I think what saves you from that is just always reminding yourself, like, the best way to be a better thinker and a better person, quite frankly, is to always engage with the best version of opposing arguments and opposing worldviews and all the rest.
You know, another personal question in this vein that kind of relates to my story, you know, you're a, you know, high school college Republican, you're doing these early internships, you're writing for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I like myself, like I, especially like in my earlier 20s, was much more to the right. I'm finding I'm much more towards the center left. I'm kind of wondering, is the lesson of both of our stories that you just shouldn't be aggressively political when you're 21, 22, 23? Like, how do you, I haven't quite answered, I mean, because we're here, so to a certain degree it works, but obviously there's the whole debate of like, there's a bunch of like carcasses by the road who didn't make it there. So how do you think, I haven't answered this question myself, but because I'm thinking, you know, I'm getting married next year, so I'm thinking like, if like my kid was super political in high school, would you like encourage that? Would you discourage that? Like, how do you think about this dynamic?
No, that's an interesting question. I mean, to an extent, I just don't think we have much of a say of what young people do. I think, I mean, at a very like basic level, you know, your brain isn't fully developed until you're in your mid to late 20s anyway. And there's also just like a lot of kind of subconscious stuff that goes on. So if, as we all know, if you've ever been, I'm not a parent, but, you know, I'm surrounded by parents and I was a child and still am a child. You know, you tend to, children rebel against their parents. So if you, if you push for one direction, they're going to go in the other direction. So, and, you know, part of life is, you know, growing up is about fucking up. And constantly fucking up and constantly, you know, if you're doing life well, I think you're constantly trying to learn from those mistakes. So, you know, to say that like, oh, the answer is to not fuck up in the beginning, to me, it's that it's, you know, it's a bit of a performative self-contradiction, because life itself, I mean, that is what life is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the best advice that I give to young people, you know, which relates to the answer to my last question, is just always trying to realize that we have very feeble minds. We're seeing a very, very small corner of existence. And we're only living here in this world, on this rock, for basically a millisecond in relation to the cosmos. And with that, hopefully will come a certain level of humility, that will allow you and those around you to grow in ways that are healthy and that help everyone else, as opposed to hurts everyone else.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I would argue, and I kind of wrestle with this in the book a bit, but I think empire and the imperialist culture that surrounds and suffuses every aspect of imperialist societies is actually all about the opposite. Because from the start, again, imperialism, empire is about, you know, this self-understanding that me or people like me have a right to rule, police, dominate other groups of people. I mean, it always gets couched in more more palatable language. So, you know, we have a right to bring democracy or freedom to this group of people, or we have a right to prevent atrocity, you know, atrocities in this nation or that nation. But I think ultimately, if you look at the history of what we now consider empires, and you look at the language they've used, and you look at the history of the United States, particularly in the past 20 years, and I would also argue throughout the Cold War, there was a whole lot of domination going on, and there was not a lot of humility going on. And I think domination and humility, you know, don't tend to go hand in hand. In fact, I think to a large degree, they're opposites. And yeah, I could go on about that, but, I look forward to your next question.
Yeah, no, it's, I want to pick up on something you just said, you know, the right to intervene, because look, a decently hawkish center left like person, so who grew up during the Bush era. So I'm going to cringe if I see George W. Bush giving a 2005 inaugural address where he gives the big speech about democracy in the face of everything that's happening in Iraq, obviously. I was just old enough to remember 9/11 and those kind of years. And I'm obviously not going to say that. I'm not going to say the U.S. is a truly exceptional nation and this, or that. But I am going to say there are a lot of cases where we should do things to intervene, to prevent. Do we have like this grand, like existential right to intervene wherever we want? No, but there are cases where we should. How do you suggest I or people who hold my perspective, because it seems like we tend to be winning the debate right now in terms of U.S. foreign policy and the Biden administration, how do we police that belief without going into excess?
Yeah, no, definitely. So again, I think there's a lot of people doing good work on this. So there was a paper published by a professor at Yale. I believe their name is Osley Bali, but I might be wrong. They wrote a white paper basically called The Humanitarian Paradox, how human rights requires restraint effectively. And it's to a large degree a history of the last 20 years and how, you know, basically a kind of reckoning with the actual results of this humanitarian impulse, which is admirable and to some degree, like you said, necessary, but all the unintended consequences that came of it. And of course, the other aspect of this, yes, like part of the story of the last 20 years is about unintended consequences, but it's also about intended consequences. I mean, humanitarian interventionism has never, ever been, you know, the only driving force of U.S. policy or policy for any government or ruling elite ever. I mean, there's always economic interests, political, socio, geopolitical interests. And to the extent that a lot of the people in the Bush administration, and for that matter, a lot of the Democratic Party members that went along with the war on terror, to the extent that they always saw the war on terror as an opportunity to either maintain or expand U.S. capitalist influence in the greater Middle East and in Africa, they succeeded in that regard, at least for a certain amount of years they did. So, you know, I think this paper, Humanitarian Paradox, does kind of, you know, acknowledges that it was never just about humanitarianism, but even the humanitarian objectives weren't met by their own standards or by their own rubric. You know, terrorism throughout the world increased as the war on terror was allowed to resume or allowed to proceed. And overall violence and instability in the greater Middle East was exacerbated. The global arms trade is totally out of control. And I keep on mentioning Africa because this is one place that most Americans have no idea the effect that the war on terror has had in that part of the world. But I mean, you know, Africa has struggled a lot. Again, legacies of empire and colonialism. But the war on terror has not made things easier for Africa. I mean, there's all sorts of places, particularly in Northern Africa and the Horn of Africa, and even increasingly sub-Saharan Africa, where a lot of the instability there is being driven by military partnerships and booming arms industries that simply were not there prior to the war on terror. So I think in answer to your question, you know, we have to start with acknowledging this history and realizing, like, whenever you send arms somewhere, or wherever, you know, you sign another funding package for the Department of Defense, there are all sorts of consequences to that, short term and long term, that don't fit into this convenient narrative of humanitarian intervention, protecting people from atrocities and all the rest. Does that mean that we should never send arms to other peoples that we believe deserve them or have the right to have them? No. I mean, like I said, you know, in the beginning of this conversation, personally, I support arming the Ukrainians. But the point is that needs to be like a very difficult choice to make. It really does need to be the last resort in all contexts. And we have to demand of our leaders like good explanations for why they're doing this, how long they're going to do it, like, and also like cost benefit analysis. How are we going to really like there should be like, you know, demands made on the part of the voters, like how much money are we going to spend? How long is this going to go on? You know, what are our metrics for success or failure? You know, also asking, like, if we're arming the Ukrainians, why aren't we also arming, I don't know, the people of Saudi Arabia or Palestinians or a number, you know, all sorts of oppressed groups around the world? I think those are fair questions to at least to ask. I'm not saying that there isn't a good answer to why we don't arm all these other groups of people, but I think these are the types of questions that should be asked by Americans. And I welcome that kind of questioning. And I think anyone who's really interested in a humble approach to policy, particularly policy involving war and war making, these are the types of questions we should be encouraging rather than discouraging. And we live in a political culture, at least among the elite, where these questions are constantly being sidelined.
You know, that's a perfect lead into my second to last question here. I referenced AOC, Ilhan Omar, basically supporting the status quo policy in Ukraine, which is in contravention to tweets. Once again, tweets are silly, but tweets that they kind of put out at the start of the war. You know, AOC talking about her concerns with the military industrial complex, and Ilhan Omar speaking to concerns about flooding Ukraine with weapons and the risk in that sense. And if you watch the various reactions that AOC and Ilhan have had to the protesters, who I think are largely operating in bad faith at their events, and some of the Twitter debates, it's clear that they don't quite have an overall framework for navigating the broad space between fear that some dude who works for Raytheon's going to get a second pool and the fact that Ukrainians are fighting and dying and just the underlying like reality here. So if you could sit down with either of them or basically any progressive policymaker, because the progressives in Congress clearly, and I mean this seriously, this isn't like, I don't think I'm being partisan here. As we saw if the letter getting withdrawn the way it was, the letter being their essential kind of like critique of the Biden process, I don't think there's a strong framework here. How would you suggest they develop a framework? So not telling them you support weapons for 14 weeks and at week 15 you cut it off, but like, how do you suggest progressives who frankly were elected for domestic economic political reasons, let's get real, how should they go about thinking through the next year or two?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I'm not a policymaker. I don't have a lot of experience other than like internships 25 years ago with policymaking. So I feel reluctant to answer this question as well with any, you know, real confidence. But I do think at a very, you know, I do think that some of the demands that should be put forward by the left should be conditions, you know, that are attached to support for arming Ukraine. I mean, if the concern is that the military industrial complex is going to benefit from arming Ukraine, which I think is true, then why not demand taxing the military industrial complex and redirecting that revenue to socially beneficial projects, whether it be climate policy or whether it be addressing the real social and economic issues globally that I think lead to a lot of, or certainly encourage a lot of, the instability that we're seeing around the world. So you know, I would begin with that. I mean, there's a lot of history here of demands like that. You know, some people have heard of war taxes, you know, taxing the rich during times of war. You know, it's a very kind of basic version of this, but there were five military contractors that have accumulated most of the wealth from our wars in the past 20 years. I mean, you're talking about trillions of dollars that has been redirected to these five companies. There was the Watson Institute did an incredible study on this. You know, most of that money doesn't belong in the hands of these executives. I mean, not just for, you know, moral reasons, but a very practical level, like we need that money for other things in order to live in a more stable society moving forward, both in the United States and globally. So I think there's a case to be made why we should be arming the Ukrainians right now. You know, I think that if I were to put forward that case in really simple terms, I would say that in the absence of the kind of post-imperial global institutions that I want, we still have to make it clear to those in power that the risks and consequences of wars of aggression, of violating the territorial integrity of other states, are too high. And the only way we can do that at the moment is by arming the Ukrainians and making it very clear to Putin and those that think like Putin that the consequences and the risks will be the same or even worse in the future if these types of wars of aggression continue. But if you're going to make that case, which I'm perfectly fine making, it needs to be in conjunction with something like a war tax, about redirecting a lot of the revenue and profits that are coming from these wars and these global arms trades to socially beneficial projects.
So for the last question, I really want to know what you say here. I have no regrets about spending plenty of time in like right-wing think tank world, because in many ways, because I was intellectually honest, I learned things that still inform how I look at the world today. So I think far too many people in the mainstream spaces are far too, what do you mean you guys don't agree with, like, let me put it this way. What do you mean like people are skeptical of fact checks? I entirely get that critique, right? You spend any time in a right-wing space and you just imbibe the idea, oh yeah, like there's a whole part of the country that doesn't trust that fact checkers are neutral. I'm not arguing against fact checking, but I just get that. When people bring that up. So like, what's something you picked up when you were...
Leftists get that too, by the way.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Because what you're saying is anyone who's basically not within that center left to center right band understands that, right? So like you and I are never going to say, and I noticed you caught yourself. Well, I'm going to defer myself to the experts because like you're never going to make that mistake. Yeah. If you're on the if you're on the right or the left, you're not going to make that mistake. Like, what's something that you've learned other than that thing we just got into here that you've brought to your current work beyond that?
Yeah. So, you know, interestingly, I talked about this on actually the Van Jackson podcast. But one of the thinkers that kind of moved me leftward was Christopher Lash, the historian Christopher Lash, who is famous for starting off, you know, in Marxist or Marxian circles. And he did a lot of work on a lot of scholarly work on the left. And then he had a bit of a conservative, some might say reactionary turn toward the end of his life, particularly when it came to questions of feminism and gender. But, you know, he wrote a beautiful book called The True and Only Heaven. And that book had a major impact on my life. And I actually ended up going to graduate school at his department at the University of Rochester. But, you know, one of the running themes of that book is that modernity and everything we associate with modernity, whether it's, you know, large scale forms of production specifically commodity production and innovation and even democracy to some extent and civilization, these all come with all sorts of costs for people. And that there are competing interests within societies as these institutions emerge and really kind of establish themselves. And we should, you know, not just morally, but also as a matter of political strategy, we should spend a lot of time empathizing with those people that are bearing the brunt of these costs. I mean, a great example of this right now is like, I actually am generally a free trade leftist, if you want to put it that way. I'm not I'm not for the plutocratic trade agreements that we've seen for so many years now. But I do believe in all dynamic trading among different groups of people around the world. With that said, like, I also am very cognizant of how opening up borders to trade changes the everyday material realities for millions of people. Regardless of what you think of free trade, I think the big mistake that neoliberals made is that they weren't cognizant enough of those costs. I would even say the same. So when it comes to social, what we consider social issues, when it comes to questions of race and gender and sexuality and all the rest, I'm very much on the left. But I think for people like myself that very much are on the left on these issues, we have to be, it's for that very reason, we have to be much more empathetic to those that, you know, are coming from different places. Since I started on the right and since I was in the Marine Corps for 5 years, a lot of the people in my life do not share my politics, not just on economic issues, but a lot of this cultural stuff either. But I think I've become a more effective communicator on behalf of these leftist politics precisely because so many of the people I know don't have that politics. I forget what the original question was, but
you answered it. I think you've really centered on the, it prevents you from thinking, from being a fish that doesn't recognize water because it's what it swims in. Jeremy, this has been really great. Sorry, Lyle, this has been great. You've got a Lyle, Jerry Rubin, this has been a really great conversation. Could you shout the book out for listeners? It's available in our bookshop.
I've been through a few podcasts now, so I know that you hold up the book. It's like kind of backwards. I'm not sure how everyone else sees it.
It's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, it's correct. Okay, good. So Pain is Weakness, Leaving the Body. You can really purchase it anywhere. The way the system works is it benefits me the most if more people buy it from Amazon because the rankings go up, but I'm very much a partisan of small independent bookstores. So if you prefer that, you know, go to a website like IndieBound or Bookshop so you can support local distributors as well.
Thanks for joining me on The Realignment. This has been really great.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.